14. Like a voice in a nightmare, the laughter followed after Parsons as he raced along the base of the cliff. I was right, he thought. Pausing once, he looked back. There on the beach, Stenog and his men waited for Corith. From the sand, they had fished up what they had been searching for, a deadly, gleaming little weapon. They had managed to complete the time travel experiments. Catching hold of roots and branches, Parsons scrambled up the cliff wall. I have to get to him first, he thought. I have to warn him. Rocks tumbled away. He sprawled and rolled back, clutching. The figures below became smaller. They made no move to follow him. Why don't they shoot me? He asked himself. Now a ledge of rock came between him and Stenog. Gasping, he rested for a minute, out of sight, protected. But he had to go on. Struggling up, he seized a tree root and continued on up. Don't they think I can stop him? He wondered. Is it foreordained that he will go through his cycle, be killed no matter what I do? Am I going to fail? Now, reaching out, he managed to catch hold of the turf at the crest of the cliff. He was able to pitch himself up onto the level ground, but at once he was up again on his feet. Where was Corith? Somewhere, not far off. Trees grew ahead, a grove of wind-bent pines. He entered the grove, panting for breath. Back and forth he ran, searching among the trees. I can't blame Stenog, he thought. He's protecting his society. It's his job. And this is my job, he realized, to save my patient, the man I was called on to heal. He stopped now, winded, unable to go on. Sinking down, he sat in the damp grass in the shadows, resting and recovering. His fur garments were torn from scrambling up the cliff. Drops of blood oozed from his arm. He wiped it off on the grass. Strange, he thought. Stenog, with his dark skin dyed white, masquerading as a white man. And myself, with my white skin dyed dark, masquerading as an Indian. And a white man struggling to help Corith kill Drake. And Stenog, on the other, taking Drake's place. Or not taking Drake's place, but actually Drake. Is there an authentic Drake? Or is Stenog Drake? Was there another man actually born in England in the early 16th century named Francis Drake? Or has Stenog always been Drake? And there is no other person. If there is another Drake, a real Drake, then where is he? One thing he knew. The engraving and portrait had been made of Al Stenog with beard and white skin in Drake's place. So Stenog, not Drake, had come back to England from the New World with the plunder and been knighted by the Queen. But had Stenog then continued to be Drake for the rest of his life? Had that been Stenog who fought the Spanish warships later on in the war against Spain? Who had been the great navigator? Drake or Stenog? An intuition, the exploits of those explorers, the fantastic navigation and courage. Each of them, Cortez, Pizarro, Cabrillo, each of them a man transplanted from the future, an imposter, using equipment from the future. No wonder a handful of men had conquered Peru and another handful Mexico. But he did not know. If Corith died while trying to reach Drake, there would be no reason for Stenog, for the government of the future, to go on. The man could die only once. Parsons got shakily to his feet. He began to walk, preserving his strength. The man is here somewhere, he told himself. If I keep looking, I'll eventually find him. There's no need for a panic reaction. It's only a question of time. Ahead of him, among the trees, someone moved. Cautiously, he approached. He saw several figures, reddish skin, furs. Had he found him? Reaching out, he spread apart the foliage. On the far side of a rise, the metallic sphere of a time ship caught the afternoon sun. One of them, he realized. But which one? Not the one he himself had come in. That was hidden elsewhere, disguised with mud and branches. This one sat out in the open, There would be at least 4 time ships, assuming that this trip was the last. I wonder if I will ever make any more, he thought. If, like Loris and Nexina, I will come again, like a ghost, haunting this spot, seeking a way to change the flow of past events. One of the figures turned, and Parsons saw. Who? A woman he did not recognize, a handsome woman, in her 30s, like Loris, but not Loris. The woman's black hair tumbled down her bare shoulders, her strong chin raised as she stood listening. She wore a skirt of hide around her waist, an animal pelt. Her naked breasts glistened, swayed as she turned her body. A wild-eyed, fierce woman who now dropped, crouching, alert. A second woman appeared, elderly and frail, hesitantly stepping from the time ship, wrapped in heavy robes. The younger woman was Jepthy, Loris's mother, at an earlier time when she was here before. Nexina said, in a voice familiar to Parsons,
Why did you let him get out of sight?
You know how he is, Jepthy shot back in a husky voice. How could I stop him? She leaped up, tossing her mane of hair back. Maybe we should go to the cliff. We might find him again there. I am back 35 years, Parsons realized. Loris has not been born. Barefoot, Jepthy hurried from the ship into the trees. Her long legs carried her quickly. She vanished almost at once, leaving the old woman to catch up.
Wait for me, Nexina called anxiously.
Reappearing, Jepthy said, Hurry! She emerged from the trees to help her mother. You shouldn't have come. Watching the supple body, the energetic loins, Parsons thought, But she has already conceived. Loris is in her womb now, as I'm looking at her. And one day she will nurse at those superb breasts. He began to hurry through the trees, back in the direction of the cliff. Corath had left his time ship. At least he knew that. The man was on his way, approaching what he imagined to be Drake. Ahead of him, he saw the Pacific. He emerged on the cliff once more. The sunlight momentarily blinded him, and he halted, shielding his eyes. Far off, also on the cliff edge, he saw a single figure, a man standing on the edge. The man wore a loincloth. On his head, a horned buffalo skull jutted up, covering him almost to his eyes. Black hair hung down from beneath the buffalo skull. Parsons ran toward him. The man did not seem aware of him. He bent down, gazing over the edge of the cliff at the ship below. His enormous copper-colored body was splashed with paint streaks of blue and black and orange and yellow across his chest, his thighs, his shoulders, even his face. Over his back, a pelt-covered mass was tied to him by a thong that passed over his chest and strapped beneath his armpits. Weapons there, Parsons decided, and binoculars. The man whipped a pair of binoculars from the pack on his back and, squatting down, studied the beach. Of all of them, Parsons thought, Corath had by far the best disguise. It was worthy of his great preparation, his months of secret effort. The magnificent buffalo skull, with tatters of skin flapping in the ocean wind, the blazing bands of paint slashed across his body, a warrior in the prime of life. Now, lifting his head, Corath noticed him. Their eyes met. Parsons was face to face with him. With the living man, for the first time. And, he wondered, the last? Seeing him, Corath stuck the binoculars back into his pack. He did not seem alarmed. There was no fear on his face. His eyes flashed. The man's mouth was set, the teeth showing, almost a grin. Suddenly, he sprang to the edge of the cliff. In an instant, he had gone over the side. He had vanished.
Corath!
Parsons shouted. The wind whipped his voice back at him. His lungs labored as he reached the spot, dropped down, saw the loose rock sliding where Corath had gone. The fanatic, cunning assassin had gotten away. Without knowing or caring who Parsons was or why he wanted him, or how he had known his name. Corath did not intend to stop for anything. He could not take the chance.
Making his way down, Parsons thought, I've lost him. The man had already gotten past him, down the cliffside. Why did I think I could stop him, he asked himself, when they failed? His mother, his son, his wife, his daughter, the family itself, the wolf tribe. Sliding, half falling, he reached a projection and halted. He could see no sign of the man. On the beach, the small boat was still drawn up in the surf. The five men had collected by their weapon, concealing it. The bearded man wandered away, glanced up, continued to roam, pretending that he doesn't know, Parsons thought. The decoy. Taking hold of an outcropping, Parsons started cautiously on. He turned about to face the cliff. A few feet from him, Corith crouched. The relentless eyes bored at him. The face, inflamed with conviction, glowed. Corith held a tube in his hands, an elongated version of the weapon familiar to Parsons. With this, no doubt, he intended to kill Drake.
You called me by name, Corith said.
Parsons said, don't go down there.
How do you know my name?
I know your mother, he said. Nixina, your wife, Jepthy.
I've never seen you before,
Corith said. His eyes flickered. He studied Parsons, licking at his lower lip. Poised to spring, Parsons realized. Ready to leap away and on down the cliff. But he thought, he will kill me first, with that tube. I want to warn you, Parsons said. He felt dizzy. For a moment, black flecks passed in front of him, and the cliff wavered and began receding. The glare of the sun, the stark white sand, the ocean. He sat listening to the noise of the surf. Over it, he could hear Corith's breathing, the rapid, constricted spasms.
Who are you?
Corith said. You don't know me, he said.
Why shouldn't I go down there?
It's a trap. They're waiting for you. The massive face quivered. Corith raised the tube that he held.
It doesn't matter.
They have the same weapons you have, Parsons said.
No,
Corith said. Wheel lock rifles. That's not Drake down there. Now the black eyes flamed furiously. The face became distorted. Parsons said, the man down there is Al Stenog. To that, Corith said nothing. He did not seem to react. The director of the fountain, Parsons said. After a long time, Corith said,
the director of the fountain is a woman named Lou Farnes.
At that, Parsons stared. Corith said,
you're lying to me. I've never heard of anybody named Stenog.
They sat crouched against the rock surface of the cliff, facing each other silently.
Your speech, Corith said. You have an accent.
Parsons' mind raced. The whole thing had a ring of madness in it. Who was Lou Farnes? Why had Corith never heard of Stenog? And then he understood. 35 years had passed since Corith's death. Stenog was a young man, no more than 20. He had not become director until long after Corith's death. In fact, he had not even been alive when Corith died. The woman, Lou Farnes, was undoubtedly the director of the fountain during Corith's lifetime. Relaxing a little, Parsons said, I'm from the future. His hands were still shaking. He tried to quiet them. Your daughter.
My daughter,
Corith echoed with a mocking grimace. If you go any further down, Parsons said, you'll be shot through the chest, killed. Your body will be taken back to your own time, to the Wolf Lodge, and put into Cold Pack. For 35 years, your mother and your wife, and finally your daughter, will try to undo your death. They'll give up eventually and call me in. Corith said,
I don't have any daughter.
But you will, he said. You do now, in fact, but you don't know it. Your wife has conceived. With no indication that he had heard him, Corith said,
I must go down there and kill that man.
If you want to kill him, Parsons said, I'll tell you how you can do it. Not by going down there.
How?
Corith said. In your own time, before he solves the problem of time travel and comes back here. That was the only way.
He had worked it out in his mind, examined the alternatives. Here, he knows. There, if you go back, he doesn't. He didn't know about you when I was with him. All he had was a series of conjectures to go on, shrewd guesses. But he was able to put them together. They resumed time travel experimentation, and finally they were successful. Leaning urgently toward Corith, he went on. Those weapons that you have won't help you here because... He broke off. From the pack strapped to Corith's body, something stuck up. Something that made cold, bleak fright rise inside him. Your costume, he managed to say. You constructed it yourself. No one else saw it. He reached toward Corith, toward the pack. From the pack, he took a handful of arrows, with flint tips and feathered with familiar colors. Fakes, Parsons said, which you made as part of your disguise, to come back here. Corith said, look at your arm. What? He said, dazed. You're a white man, Corith said. The dye has rubbed off where you got scratched. Suddenly, he seized hold of Parsons' arm and yanked him toward him. He spat on Parsons' arm and rubbed at his flesh. The dye, moistened, rubbed away, leaving a spot of grayish white. Letting go of his arm, he caught hold of the artificial hair braided into Parsons. In an instant, he had torn the artificial hair away. He sat holding it in his hand, and then, without a word, he sprang at Parsons. Now I see, Parsons thought. He tumbled back over the lip of the rock and down the cliffside. Snatching, scrabbling, he managed to catch hold. His body dragged agonizingly against the rock. And then, above him, Corith appeared, the massive body descending. Parsons rolled away, trying to avoid him. No, he thought. I don't want to. The copper-colored hands closed around his throat, and he felt the man's knee dig into him. Against him, Corith sagged. Blood gushed, staining the ground as it gurgled and became pools. Parsons, with a violent effort, managed to struggle out from beneath the man. He held now only one arrow, and he did not have to turn Corith over to see where the other was. As the man had dropped onto him, he had propped the arrow upright, and it had gone into his heart. I killed him, Parsons thought. By accident. Above, on the edge of the cliff, Jephthah appeared. They'll know, he realized, in a moment, and when they find out. Pressing against the cliff, he moved away from the dying man, crawling along the rock surface until he could no longer see either the woman or Corith. Then, step by step, he began ascending the cliff. He reached the top. No one was in sight. They had gone down to Corith, but they would be back up immediately. His mind empty, he ran from the cliff toward the grove of trees. Presently, he was out of sight among them. Safe, he thought. No one will know. Now they won't know. The mystery of his death, they will never find out. I did not intend to, he thought, but that makes no real difference. No wonder Stenog laughed. He knew it was going to be I who killed Corith. Stopping, he stood deep in frantic thought. I can go back to Loris and Helmar, he decided. Tell them that I saw only what they saw. Corith on the cliff, going down, and then Corith die. No one else. Nobody came up the cliff from below. The only ones who came down were Jephthah and Nixina. I don't know any more than they do. And Corith will never tell because he is dead. Hiding, he heard voices. He saw Nixina and Jephthah rushing through the trees, searching for their time ship, their faces blank with grief. Going to get the ship, put him into it, take him back and get him into Coldpack. Corith is dead, but 35 years from now, he will be brought back to life. I will do it. I will be there in the lodge, responsible for his rebirth. He knew now why the second arrow had appeared in Corith's chest, why he had not remained alive. The first time he had killed Corith by accident, but not the second time. That would be on purpose. I must have come back, he realized, in one of the time ships.
That night, I revived Corith while he lay unconscious, recuperating. While I was with Loris, I was also downstairs with him. But why with an arrow? He looked down at his hand. He still clutched one arrow. Scrambling up the cliff, he had hung on to it. Why? He asked himself. Because the arrows saved my life. If I hadn't had them, Corith would have killed me. I was defending myself. There had been no choice. And yet, he felt dread, the horror of responsibility. He had been trapped, drawn into it against his will. Corith had leaped on him, and he had done nothing but struggle to protect himself. What else could I have done? He asked himself. Surely it isn't my fault. But if not, then whose fault is it? Who really was responsible for the crime? And it was a crime. Any killing is a crime. I'm a doctor, he said to himself. My job is to save human life, especially this man's life. But at the cost of my own? Because when I revive him at the lodge, he will point me out, and I will be helpless. Because I will not know. This has not happened for me yet.